That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.
All right, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Max Politics with Ben Max coming up.
Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Thanks very much for tuning in here for the show. It's Friday, March 17th, 2023. There are 2 weeks left in the month, and that means there's 2 weeks left in this New York State fiscal year, 2 weeks left until state leaders need to come together on a new state budget by the April 1st start of next state fiscal year. Now, that's the formal deadline. They often pass the budget late. Last year, it was a little over a week late. It's been much later than that in some years past. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo used to make it a very big priority, especially his first bunch of years in office, to have it in on time. But that often meant very, very last minute deals that nobody had actually read, and they were passing it in the middle of the night. A lot of that has continued. But now we are into the second budget under Governor Kathy Hochul. She outlined her agenda earlier this year in her State of the State address and then her executive budget, which was for a total of $227 billion for next fiscal year. That became the subject of state legislative hearings over the course of weeks. And now, just this week, both houses of the state legislature presented, debated, and passed their individual one house budget resolutions, which are outlining negotiation postures, really, statements of values, putting some different numbers on some things, counter proposals to the governor's plan, and such. They are not binding by any means. But they now set the stage for the final 2 weeks of negotiations between Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, and the two Democratic supermajorities in the state legislature, the state Senate, led by Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, a recent guest here on the show. Hopefully you heard that conversation earlier this year. And Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie. Hopefully we'll be having him on the show at some point. But the legislative leaders, the governor, some of their top aides, a few other legislators from each house will be really taking the lead on negotiations. Much of that will occur behind closed doors, but there will be lots of public discussion and many, many other stakeholders trying to influence the outcome of the final state budget, including Mayor Eric Adams, who has a lot at stake in terms of policy for the city, funding for the city. There's a number of instances where the mayor wants to see changes to the governor's budget plan. When he testified before the legislature, there were six big areas, and we wrote about this at Gotham Gazette if you want to find the article, pretty much six big areas where he was taking issue with some of the funding mechanisms in the governor's budget: cost shifts to the city, cuts in funding, places where the governor is pushing for the city to contribute more to things like the MTA, for example. And in most cases, the two legislative houses undid those things in their one house budget proposals from the governor's plan. So that now takes center stage as well in negotiations. But there's really a lot of areas where the state legislature and the governor seem to have agreement. And then there's some very big areas where they have different plans and philosophies. Now, in some cases, those are sort of more extreme. And in other cases, there's clearly room for some compromise. So, for example, the governor's top priority is her very big housing plan. She's got all sorts of mechanisms that she proposed to try to make sure that New York creates 800,000 new housing units over the next decade. Well, a lot of the mechanisms and the policies that she put in her plan, the legislative chambers have rejected in their one house budget proposals, but they agree with the larger targets. They want to use more incentives to get there, create more funding mechanisms for localities that build more housing to have more access to infrastructure funds and so forth. And there's a lot of debatable stuff there. So that's one example. The other one is lifting the charter school cap in New York City, for example, where the two legislative houses just rejected that idea, and the governor will see how much she's going to go to bat for it. So those are two examples of many. We will be digging into state budget negotiations next week on the show, so be sure to tune in next week here on WBAI in the 5 p.m. hour on Friday, March 24th, for a discussion about the state budget. There's a lot to dig into and a lot of different pieces under consideration, negotiations, a lot to understand about what's going on from the legislature's perspective. I'm hoping to have the governor on the show sometime before our budget's due, or maybe after they have an agreement on a budget. We'll see if we can have her on in the next few weeks sometime. And then, of course, the city's interest in what happens in the state budget will then very much impact what happens with the city's own budget negotiations between the mayor and the city council. The city gets some time to factor in the state budget into its own spending plan. So right now, there's a lot of debate over Mayor Eric Adams's preliminary budget, and city council hearings are ongoing on that. Then they get to see what happens in the state budget, try to influence it, et cetera. And then the mayor comes out with his executive budget proposal in April. Ideally, of course, they've had the state budget passed by the time the mayor has to craft that plan. Then that's the subject of hearings, and the city passes its own budget, taking into account state funding, state policy, and so forth by the July 1st start of the city's fiscal year. On this episode of the show, the Bronx. Where do things stand in the borough and where is it heading? My guest is Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson. She's just given her 2023 State of the Borough address, her first since becoming Bronx Borough President in January of 2022. She laid out an agenda headlined by quite a few things, including related to public health, economic development, and much more. Borough President Gibson is here to discuss those plans and more about the Bronx. There's a lot to get to with the Borough President, including the always important topics that she touched on in her State of the Borough of mass transit and transit access, affordable housing, public safety, and more. And of course, specific projects happening or proposed in the borough, including the redevelopment of the massive Kingsbridge Armory, the hip hop museum that's coming, four new Metro North stations and development around those stations, the new jail as part of the Rikers closure project, a possible casino in the borough, and the list goes on and on. As a reminder, the borough president is a position with somewhat limited decisive decision-making powers, but a significant bully pulpit. It has a formal and significant voice in land use matters, tens of millions of dollars annually in budgetary funds to distribute, the responsibility to appoint members to community boards and other bodies, including the City Planning Commission, community education councils, and more. Borough presidents can work with the city council. Vanessa Gibson used to be a city council member, of course, to introduce and advance legislation, but they don't get to vote. They are conveners. The position allows office holders a good bit of flexibility to focus on the issues of their choosing, crafting staff reports, pursuing legislative, budgetary, and other action, interacting with the mayor, the governor, and other elected officials, and of course, acting as an ambassador and a cheerleader for their borough and so on. This is our fourth fairly recent conversation with a borough president of the city, as I've sought to talk with each of the BPs about their agendas and often asking them to come on the show right around the time of their State of the Borough address and agenda. I've spoken in recent months with Queensboro President Donovan Richards, Brooklyn Borough President Antonio Reynoso, and Manhattan Borough President Mark Levine, all close to or pegged around their State of the Borough addresses. And we got into a lot with all of those officials, especially on some of the main responsibilities of the borough presidents related to land use matters, housing, development, and so forth. You can find those three conversations at Max Politics, wherever you get podcasts, or at the Gotham Gazette website. And I'm very happy to be joined today by Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson, who will be with me in just one moment. I'm also working on scheduling Staten Island Borough President Vito Fisella, so don't worry. We'll get to all five BPs here. He gave his first State of the Borough address as BP in January. My guest today, Vanessa Gibson, is a Democrat, a former city council member who's just finished her first year in the role of BP after winning a tough, competitive 2021 race that was, for all purposes, decided in the primary that she won that June. Vanessa Gibson is the first Black person and the first woman to be Bronx Borough president. She previously represented the 16th City Council District, including parts of Central and West Bronx. In her 8 years in the City Council, which came after a stint in the State Assembly, she focused on public safety, tenants' rights, and other issues. She chaired the City Council's Public Safety Committee, the subcommittee on the city's massive capital budget, and perhaps her biggest legislative accomplishment, although she can say what she thinks that was, is having been a co-lead sponsor, along with now Manhattan BP Levine, on the city's right to counsel law for tenants facing eviction in housing court, which helped lead to a significant decline in evictions in the pre-pandemic era and is now the focus of some challenges and attention as the city is struggling a bit to follow that law. Vanessa Gibson joins me now. Borough President Gibson, thanks for being here. How are you?
Thank you, Ben. I'm doing great. Very excited to always talk about our agenda and blueprint for the Bronx.
Excellent. So we are talking 36 hours, I guess, after your State of the Borough address on Wednesday night. So we'll get into a whole bunch of things. But what are a couple of things that you want to highlight for listeners at the top of the agenda, things that you really focused on in your speech that you've either been working on in your first year as borough president or you're pledging to work on now in your second and beyond? What are a couple of the top priorities for your office that you want to list off and mention right off the bat here?
Right. So some of the top priorities for our administration moving forward is really focusing on the Bronx being a borough of opportunities and the highlights of being a cultural revolution and a renaissance, boosting tourism and focusing on cultural institutions and really bringing tourism back to the Bronx. The second is healthcare, maternal healthcare, as one of my biggest priorities, focusing on wraparound services for Black and Latina women who are more likely to die during childbirth. Housing, I am ready to build, along with my fellow borough presidents, affordable housing opportunities and home ownership opportunities, which builds a pathway to the middle class. And finally, but certainly not the only, is economic development. It is a pathway to prosperity when you talk about jobs, good paying, stable union jobs that really create stability for many of the families I represent.
One of the things that stuck out to me from your State of the Borough address that hits that last category, so let's talk about it now, is talking about the Bronx as a potential hub for the burgeoning cannabis industry.
Yes.
What are you trying to do on that? What are you hopeful about? Of course, the way that the state law legalizing adult use recreational cannabis was designed was to try to ensure opportunity for people previously convicted of lower level marijuana offenses. Obviously, many people from the Bronx faced challenges around those offenses during, you know, the war on drugs and the heightened criminalization of marijuana. So that must be a key factor in sort of the idea that some Bronxites would be able to do that. But there's also barriers to that. You have to have not only have a conviction of a certain kind, but you have to show some that you've had some ability to run a business. You know, that's not always the easiest thing to do. So what are you hoping to do on cannabis, and what can your office, the borough presidency, do on this issue?
Right. So I talked about it in our State of the Borough because I fully believe that cannabis is an industry that we must embrace. With the legalization of marijuana passed by the legislature a few years ago, I believe it can really be a game changer. And I look at it from both an equity and a justice perspective. Equity, because we want to create and be a next emerging entrepreneurs and small business owners. But we also know from a justice perspective, we want to right the wrongs of systemic racism and mass incarceration due to marijuana prohibition and many Black and Latino men and women that have been jailed and incarcerated and traumatized because of marijuana prohibitions. So I look at it from both the equity and the jobs perspective and justice, and I really believe in what it can do. And I joined last June June with the Bronx Community Foundation, Bronx Defenders, and others. And we had a cannabis showcase at the Bronx GPO on 149th Street. They hosted us on a weekend, Friday to Sunday, and we had a cannabis showroom. We brought in private sector, city, state agencies, the Office of Cannabis Management, Small Business Services, and we really showcased what cannabis is all about. And we want this industry to be emerging, but we want to make sure it's done in a legal way. And as you said, it's really hard for entrepreneurs and small businesses because there are requirements. There's certain capital that's necessary. Your credit, you know, needs to be up and running. So there's lots of things that we know many people face as barriers. And so we are trying to help support them in that effort. Some of the legal assistance, the technical assistance, the application process. So we have worked with the Community Foundation, Dr. Misha Porter, and the Bronx Defenders, and we've put together this cohort where we're actually helping provide free pro bono legal assistance for anyone that is interested in becoming a legal dispensary. We know that several have opened up in the city of New York, predominantly in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, but we know that it's only a matter of time before it comes to the Bronx. I know that there are a lot of unlicensed operators, and I believe that we can turn them into legal operators. And we've talked to some of those workers, and they don't even know they're working for an unlicensed cannabis employer. They don't even know. They just get jobs and they don't know. So I feel like it's an industry that we're trying to make sure it's legalized and done in decency and in order, but there will always be those that want to take advantage of the system. And we cannot accept that because the people that are doing this legitimately are working really hard to get these licenses so they can become a cannabis dispensary.
You know, you hit right on my next question on the subject, which was about the proliferation of the illegal shops, because there's obviously standing up a new industry is challenging, and the state did it with a lot of different regulations. As we are getting at, some with very good intentions, of course, to try to right past wrongs. But the way in which so many illegal shops or shops selling illegal have proliferated, has that been something where the state and the city really were just sort of caught sleeping on that? Is that something where you were trying to get more attention to this issue, but it was just such a challenge because of so many other challenges that the new mayor was facing when he came into office? I mean, this is, you know, especially with your background chairing the Public Safety Committee, the City Council, you know, I'm wondering how what you're reflecting on with this challenge, because it seems like they've been cracking down a lot more lately, but things really got out of hand for a while on this.
I agree. I think things really did get out of hand. And of course, I always look at ways of improvement and really collaboration. You know, when the state enacts these major reforms, bail reform, raise the age, cannabis legalization, there has to be messaging for the entire state across the spectrum. But we also have to coordinate with our law enforcement partners. There needs to be training for NYPD, for probation, for corrections, for the sheriff's department, you know, to make sure that we understand what is happening. Because at the end of the day, they enforce everything. And if they don't have the tools in their toolbox, then they're going to be unprepared. I don't think we could have ever envisioned the eruption of the smoke shops the way we have seen, right? Before the legalization of cannabis, remember, we had hookah. So we had a lot of our smoke shops that had hookah all over the place. And now it's not just hookah. Now it's e-cigarettes. Now it's vaping. I mean, there's so much exposure to our children. And I understand. I do. As a young Black woman, I understand. As an aunt of a nephew and my niece, I understand what children are experiencing. And so I hear a lot from constituents that are concerned about the proliferation, the smoke shops. And what we've also seen in the past several weeks is we've seen a lot of violence. We've seen robberies. We've seen shootings at some of these smoke shops because people know that they not only have marijuana, but they have cash. And that is a challenge. So I've talked to NYPD here in the borough about how we can crack down on them. But you understand and you know that as quickly as we close one, it reopens again or it opens in another space. And so it's a revolving system that we have to get a handle on. And so we need our partners at the state. We need OCM to come in and help us. Because as we expand on the legalized ones, that means that more of the unlicensed ones are going to emerge too. So I really think, again, we have to do more on education, more on outreach. I would love to see more PSAs and public service campaigns and announcements about what the legalization really means, because I do believe that there is a big divide when it comes to generations. The older generation doesn't understand what we've done, and they don't necessarily like it from the perspective of health and asthma and other debilitating, you know, diseases that people live with. And then the younger generation, they're all customers and clients, so they love it. And so I think sometimes, depending on who you talk to, there's this varying of opinions as to the legalization of marijuana. So what I'm trying to do as bar president is find a medium, find a balance. How can we embrace it in a legal way, crack down on the unlicensed, but also do a lot more to educate? I don't want children to be subjected to e-cigarettes and vaping and all these other things that I know are not helpful. They're harmful for our kids, especially representing the Bronx, when we have such high rates of asthma and heart disease and obesity and so many things we're plagued with. This would only exacerbate that. And I'm very mindful of that.
Right. I mean, you get at the issue of the question of does prohibition of something like this work? And we obviously saw that it hasn't really worked. So they decided to legalize and regulate. And then you have to have the education piece, and you have to have people understanding the risks and the dangers, and ensuring that the process of legalization doesn't just mean necessarily a free for all. Mm-hmm. Related to what we're discussing here, one of your campaign promises that came up in your State of the Borough address was to create in the borough president's office a division, an office of public safety. Say a little bit about what that is going to look like and do when you get it up and running, I assume this year.
Yes. So I've talked about this extensively. It's been a priority of mine, and just getting it up and running, of course, is a challenge. It's never been done before. Public safety to me is the prosperity to the middle class, to stability, to quality of life, to making sure that New Yorkers are given the fundamental rights that they are afforded. I think everyone has an expectation to be safe in their communities and their neighborhoods. And I think a lot of people have felt that the city is spiraling out of control and they don't feel safe. Subway shovings, mental illness, and a lot of things that we've been confronted with during the COVID-19 era. So our Office of Public Safety is going to serve as an intermediary between law enforcement, all of our stakeholders, and the public, the crisis management system, the anti-gun violence advocates, all of the credible messengers, the trusted partners that are on the ground every day doing work to address violence, but also prevent it. School safety agents, which you know I support, NYPD, probation, corrections, right? Working with young people that are in the criminal justice system, but also making sure that they don't enter the criminal justice system in the first place. I fully believe in prevention and not always detention and being reactionary, which is what we often do. I cannot tell you how often my office has had to work with these families that are affected by violence, the shootings, the stabbings, the school violence. We reach out to these families and they are broken. And you know, they need a myriad of assistance, from the funeral expenses, burial, to trauma-informed care, to counseling, emergency transfer of other kids, emergency housing, because most mom and dads want to relocate. It is hard. That is a job in itself. And I've been doing that since I've been an elected official. And now as borough president, it's magnified even more because I deal with the whole borough. We had a quadruple shooting a couple of weeks ago and a mom lost two sons. Two. One passed on Friday, the other passed on Sunday, and she had other children. We had a 15-year-old that was killed a couple of weeks ago, and that mom had five other children. So we are constantly like troubleshooting, working with crime victims, working with this office. So what I want my Office of Public Safety to do is work on preventative measures, but also work on getting all of these stakeholders together in a collaborative way and talking about how we can keep our borough safe, how we can focus on the mental health, the youth development, the safe spaces, the recreation centers, the jobs piece, putting everything together. It's never been done before, and I don't think anyone has an office of public safety, but because I know that's the primary issue that Bronxites care about, whether it's subway safety, traffic safety, domestic violence, gender-based violence, elder abuse, I mean, I put them all together, because if you are a victim in your community, if you are a victim of a crime, whether it's identity theft or any other crime, then you need services. So my unit will put all of that together, because right now my ombudsman team gets those calls, reaches out to mom and dad, navigates with crime victims. And so we want to put this space in one unit so that that can be their only focus and build out the staff. I'm going to have a director, and then we're going to have liaisons in the office.
Now, I understand some of the need you're getting at for this, but isn't this sort of supposed to be happening within the NYPD? You know, isn't a lot of that supposed to be up to the mayor and the police department to do a lot of that? Or are you saying it's helpful always to have someone with a borough-wide perspective come in and say, here's more of where the need is, here's where we need to coordinate better, here's some hot spots you might not be seeing, or things like that? I mean, is that sort of another way of thinking about it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think on the public safety side, policy, yes. Our unit will work with the NYPD around safe streets, around, you know, coordination, NCOs, you know, patrol officers, housing, transit. Yes, yes, yes. But I think the goal of my unit is to also have the human touch. And that's one thing that I don't think NYPD always does, because if you are a victim of a crime and you have to work with the detective bureau, their job is to invest after those that are the offenders of crime. They have to gather evidence, get witnesses, and build a case for the district attorney's office, who will ultimately prosecute the case. And we've heard concerns from many families that, you know, there's always not that level of sympathy. And again, it's because a lot of detectives don't have time. They have a huge caseload. And again, they're not giving that individual attention to every family. So we want to put both of the NYPD work, the detective investigative work, as well as their community family support in one unit as well.
Mm-hmm. On the broader issue of public safety, the mayor's been in office about 14 months now, as have you, as of, you know, many other officials who were elected in the 2021 cycle, of course, huge turnover in city government. Is the Bronx getting what it needs in terms of attention from the mayor who came in focused on public safety? Are you seeing the progress? You know, we had these pandemic spikes in crime, obviously, across the board. Are you seeing the resources? Are you seeing the progress? And I know, you know, you've been someone always focused on both, you know, good policing, fair policing, but also, you know, ensuring that the NYPD has a key role in public safety. Are you seeing the resources, the focus, enough from the mayor and the NYPD, as well as policing being done the way you want it done to both ensure safety and fairness and justice? What's your assessment so far of the mayor and the police commissioner, Keyshawn Sewell?
Yes, I definitely see the impact of the mayor's leadership and Commissioner Sewell. And I also want to recognize First Deputy Commissioner Eddie Caban, who was a Bronx guy and knows the Bronx and used to serve as a cop in the Bronx. I have seen the attention. You know, remember, the mayor came out saying he was a 5-borough mayor. And I appreciate that as representative of a borough that hasn't always been given that priority. He won the Bronx in high numbers, and he always said that at the beginning of his administration. Very good friends with Ruben Diaz Jr., with my predecessor, and an overwhelming level of support and popularity in the Bronx. And I think that speaks volumes to his commitment to the Bronx. He's always here. And in our first couple of months, from the fire at Twin Parks to the 11-month-old baby that was shot in her car seat in January, there was a cop shot in Belmont in February. Just in those 3 months, we had a lot happening, and the mayor showed up. He was at Jacoby visiting the officer at St. Barnabas, and I appreciate that. And what I have seen from the perspective of NYPD is actually more deployment of officers. Every class that had graduated from the academy, we have been getting a lot of cops. And we have, obviously, we have overtime, we have the NSTs, the neighborhood safety teams that are out trying to get guns off the street. So I've seen a lot of our main precincts, the 4-0, the 4-2, the 4-3, 4-4, 4-6, 4-7, and the 4-8 and 5-2 get a lot of attention. And then the last class that graduated a couple of months ago, I was really impressed because this never happens. All 12 of our precincts, including the 4-5, which is one that's not high in terms of crime, but covers Co-op City, and the 4-9, which is Morris Park, Van Ness, which we've had some peaks in violence over there as well. We got cops there. And the 5-0, which covers Riverdale, but people always think that, you know, again, it's Riverdale, but guess what? It covers Kingsbridge and Van Cortlandt too. And so I was very grateful, and I called the commissioner to thank her because all 12 precincts got cops. And I think for a lot of residents, if you polled them today, they want to see more cops. They want to see the visibility as they travel to and from. They don't want to see cops using abusive tactics. They want to see good policing, the presence of cops along our major corridors where we've seen crime. The 4-8 is on my mind because of that quadruple shooting on Tremont in the middle of the day. I can't get it out of my mind. Four people that were shot. But I have seen the improvement, and I know end of year 2022, I know we did really well as a borough because, unfortunately, you know, the Bronx and Brooklyn North cover about 20% of the major crime categories in the entire city of New York. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't get lost on me that at any given time, there's something that's happening in my borough.
So you're pleased overall with the resources, and you think they are translating into the progress that you want to see?
Absolutely, and yes.
Let me take a quick moment to say you're listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI with Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson, a Democrat who has just finished a little more than her first year in the borough-wide position, just gave her first State of the Borough address, and we are digging into her agenda for the Bronx. A lot of interesting thoughts so far, and much more to come with Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson. In case you missed it, I've had on the show in recent weeks and months a few other borough presidents, and we'll be rounding out all five in the near future. You can find those past discussions with the borough presidents of Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan at Max Politics, wherever you get podcasts, and the Gotham Gazette website. But first, here's more with Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson. And in terms of the sort of broader holistic approach that obviously you've spoken about taking a public safety, you've already mentioned in your State of the Borough address, but also in this conversation, a whole variety of things that are not just police, right? So you obviously take that perspective in terms of things like employment opportunities, in terms of things like schooling and, you know, these issues with chronic absenteeism among kids. The Bronx was hit really hard by COVID in terms of both the public health impacts and the economic impacts.
Right.
So many of these sort of other pieces of obviously things that help create public safety as well, and opportunity. Let's talk about a couple of those. Economic opportunity. There's lots of different projects and things coming to the Bronx, but say a couple of things about your priorities in terms of development and economic opportunity that can translate into opportunities for Bronxites in the sort of near term. What are some of the things that you're either working on or on your radar that are about economic development and opportunity that are not sort of years down the road, but are something that, you know, can be, a bright spot on the horizon for people who are looking for work or better work?
Absolutely. So from an economic development perspective and our new president, Rob Walsh at the BOEDC, we're very strategic and intentional in our work to create more jobs. During the pandemic, the height of this global pandemic, we were at 25.6% of an unemployment rate. Now, post-pandemic, we're down to 7.5. Compared to four other boroughs, we're still the highest unemployment, and we have to look at the new jobs sector, future jobs, and workforce development. So when we are able to make decisions on a lot of housing projects, a lot of ULURPs, we're always looking at the local jobs, the MWBE provisions, the union jobs. We're working with building trades and many others on apprenticeship opportunities because those are tangible jobs that can happen right now, in the right now. We want to make sure that people have a real pathway. They are prepared. We want to build on a lot of the things that Ruben Diaz started, a lot of the big capital items like the Metro North expansion, the Hip Hop Museum. We recently opened the Bronx Children's Museum in December. We have the work down at La Peninsula, the Hunts Point Produce Market, the Hunts Point Forward Initiative, the renovations going on at La Riviera, aka the Orchard Beach, of course, Kingsbridge Armory, which is a little ways out, and capping the Cross Bronx. Those are obviously much, you know, more longer term projects. But for the immediacy right now, we want to make sure that we're getting people back to work. So we are looking at embracing the tech industry and gaming for what it can mean for the young professional community, for the young Gen X community that are graduating from college, that want to stay in the Bronx, that need jobs to keep them here. And the housing we need to keep them here as well. So we're looking a lot at tech. We're looking a lot at gaming. We are also having conversations now with Montefiore and Einstein on research. Because I realized I saw the mayor did an announcement in Manhattan, and I know that research is something that's going to stimulate a new wealth of jobs that are emerging in the healthcare sector. And I think that's great. And I want to make sure that we tap into that as well. You know, we have been behind for a really long time. And I feel like a lot of times we have to play catch up. But we not only have to play catch up, we have to double our efforts just so that we can compete at a level playing field with our other counterparts in the city of New York. And realizing that it's the Bronx, we have to make it attractive. And so you have to be able to stimulate the economy using some of our existing infrastructure to bring more people to the Bronx in a real tangible way.
I know you meant gaming in a different way, but of course it brings back the notion of a casino. Do you want to see a casino in the Bronx? I know, yes, I meant a different type of gaming, but yep. do you want to see a casino in the Bronx?
So let me clarify. Yes, you're right. I meant video gaming and the actual design and mechanism and design of video gaming. Right.
Understood. But absolutely.
I think casino gambling is a worthy and important conversation to have. Of course, I've been able to now meet with the Bally's Corporation, who are looking at a potential site at Ferry Point Park, where we have the Trump Golf Course. And, you know, my only concern with that particular site is it's right in the middle of the World Resorts in Queens and the Empire MGM in Yonkers. And respect to my colleagues in those counties who have done a tremendous amount of work to build community support for their expansion, they have the existing infrastructure. I don't know if the Bronx is ready for the expanded opportunity because we don't have the infrastructure yet. That site is currently a brownfield, a landfill, and I just don't know if we're ready yet. I am prepared to support the expansion of Empire because I visited a couple months ago and learned that a third of their employees are from the Bronx, and they have long-standing jobs. Many of them have been there 10, 15, 20 years, and they have good, stable jobs, and I appreciate that. And of course, I'm friends with the mayors of Mount Vernon and Yonkers and the Westchester County Executive, and so I see a huge benefit if Empire gets their expansion. But I don't want to take away from the Bronx and what it could mean. And I think the community of Throgs Neck is a different community. I want to be able to make sure that there's a real community benefit. But you understand when you're building out casinos, you're going to have hotel, restaurant, parking, small businesses, retail. So you're building a whole neighborhood within a neighborhood, and you're bringing in clientele. I want to make this beneficial for the Bronx. So I have not yet, as I still learn about this proposal, I don't see the vision of where the clientele comes from in the Bronx. And I do want to make sure that Throgs Neck and the community is in the conversation, because again, it's a different neighborhood. And I want to make sure that with respect to the residents that are there, that this is something, you know, I'm hearing 5,000 parking spaces. So that means that we are catering to people coming in and not necessarily the Bronx. But again, Ben, interesting, worthy conversation. Well, I embrace casino gambling, but also know that there are some unintended consequences that we must always be mindful of.
Well, I was just going to say, when you're talking about who the clientele is, you know, the best thing for the Bronx might be that most of the people who work at the casino are from the Bronx, and most of the people gambling at the casino and losing their money are not from the Bronx, right? I mean, that might be the best situation for any locality. All right, that's interesting. I mean, for folks that don't know, I'm hoping to have an episode of the show just on the casino process real soon, okay. So stay tuned for that.
Good.
But for folks who don't know, there's existing casinos as you mentioned, in the downstate region, but they are not allowed to have the full table games and other things that would, that you're, when you say expansion, that's exactly what you're talking about, is about going from the sort of limited casinos that they have now to the full fledged casinos. And as you get at the ones with the current licenses, some people believe might be first in line to get the expanded licenses. So
I think they have an advantage. They do. They've been doing the work, and they've been really reaching out to the local communities as well.
We only have about 10 more minutes together, so let me let me try to get to a few more things. I've got a long list here, but I'll only pick a few more. Kingsbridge Armory, you're going through a big process on the Kingsbridge Armory. We did a a pretty exhaustive piece at Gotham Gazette a couple months back on this, that the process has restarted for community input and the future of the massive Kingsbridge Armory. I know that you're letting this be community led. I know that you're working on this with many partners at various levels of government. But in terms of your vision, what are a couple of the things that you feel like are really important that are part of where the Kingsbridge Armory goes ultimately?
Right. So I am very clear about my intentions and my priorities and certain buckets that are non-negotiable for me. Whatever we do at the Kingsbridge Armory has to focus on culture, boosting tourism, creating good paying jobs, supporting small businesses and street vendors who I believe are entrepreneurs themselves. I want to have a healthcare component. I want to do something like vertical farming because I want to focus on food hubs. I would like to see a tech hub, and I want workforce development training. I want to look at current jobs as well as future jobs like gaming, like what I talked about earlier. Those are my priorities, not negotiable. I want everything to be on the table. And I do think that there is space for recreation, for young people, a recreation space. I was in the council when Lori Cumbo negotiated a Bedford Union Armory, and it was not easy. It was very controversial because it has a housing component to it, and it was market and affordable. While this armory does not have a housing component, but it's three times the size. It's huge. It's the largest in the country and has the potential to do so much for the Kingsbridge neighborhood and for the entire borough and the city. And it can be a game changer. So for me, boosting culture, boosting tourism, jobs, small businesses, those are some of the things that we want to focus on.
Okay. And are there any uses that you feel like should be off the table? Is a housing component something you think should not even be really discussed for this?
Yeah, I don't think, I think it's zoned as a C44, so I don't think that it allows for housing. I don't think housing would work with some of the multiple uses we're talking about. I mean, people have come to me about a potential studio, a movie theater, a recreation center, healthcare center, potentially the home for a museum of salsa. We're working with Tito Puente Jr. And, you know, there's lots of opportunities, but I don't envision housing. But I do want to have some component of a worker cooperative model.
Okay. Interesting. A lot more to watch for there as you continue the process. You mentioned joining your fellow borough presidents, especially those, including BP Fisella on Staten Island, but especially the others who are very focused on more housing and more housing development and being ready to build. Where do you see the greatest opportunity for more housing growth in the Bronx? There's obviously the new plans from both the governor and the mayor that are looking to really juice up housing production in the city and the state. The governor's plans would, you know, put targets that have to be met by every community district, which is pretty interesting. And you talked about this in your State of the Borough address, that every neighborhood has to do its part in the housing affordability crisis. So where do you see the greatest opportunity for more housing in the Bronx, and sort of what's your perspective on the plans that are in motion and how you're going to be, you know, a voice in that?
Right. I definitely think that Mayor Adams and Governor Hochul are very ambitious in their agenda to create thousands and thousands of units of affordable housing. And I think a lot of things have to happen as we see that come to fruition. We have to speed up housing production. There's too many families living in temporary housing and shelters today, coupled with the asylum families single adults and children that are coming into the system. The system is overwhelmed and we're not getting families into permanent housing as quickly as we should. We definitely need to make Section 8 vouchers more available and looking at project-based Section 8 and deeper affordability, even beyond MIH. I know there's conversations around a new 421A plan and potentially J51, and I support many of that, but I want to make sure that there are deeper affordability options. I struggle as borough president because not every neighborhood, not every council district has done its fair share, and I'm very intentional about making sure that it does. It's not fair that the same neighborhoods continue to bear the burden of saturated housing, of affordable housing, of shelters, of social service programs over and over and over again, whereas some neighborhoods say no, 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 and that's it. And I think these neighborhoods sometimes have not really looked at the total spectrum of what we're trying to do and really looking at what affordable housing means. Affordable housing is the prerequisite to home ownership. We don't want tenants to be lifetime tenants. We eventually want them to move towards a pathway, upward mobility of becoming homeowners. That's what everyone's desire should be. And we have to get them there at some point. So there are projects that are coming down the pipeline. I'm sure you know, Fordham Landing is going to be huge. That's about 2,500 new units of housing. It's going to be an upzoning on the west side of the Bronx in the Fordham Heights community with Councilmember Sanchez. Then there's potential opportunities in the Wakefield and Wakefield Village community in the Northeast Bronx with Councilmember Riley and Councilmember Dinowitz. There's potential opportunities in the South Bronx, some smaller projects, a couple hundred, not a thousand, because these projects to me are really going to create new neighborhoods. You can't build 1,000 units of housing and not talk about a new school. So those are things that we are putting on the table. We want schools, we want supermarkets, we want healthcare centers. We want all of that to be a part of a package. Just like when I did the Jerome rezoning, we got two schools and millions of dollars for other programs because you realize that families are coming in, they're staying, they are immigrating into the community, and you want them to transition their kids in school, the local parks, the playgrounds, the libraries, all of the neighborhood partners that really should be stable. And that's one of the concerns that we get from some neighborhoods that don't want affordable housing. They always cite the density, traffic issues, the burden on local cops, the hospital, 911 system, and those are valid concerns. And so what we don't always do, and I've said to the mayor, is when we look at these projects that bring in 1,000, 2,000 units of housing, we should automatically look at adding more cops, adding more hospital workers to the local hospital that's there, because those are some of the issues people say, we can't afford 500 more people. We can't absorb more. The traffic is a nightmare. You can't even get to and from school, you know, things like that. So that's why we're trying to be a bar president that represents more neighborhoods and looks at the density.
Now, you also know sometimes people say those things, but mostly they might be true or they might have a grain of truth, but people also just don't want their neighborhoods to change. They don't want, as you said, they don't want more development. They have certain, in some cases, unfounded concerns about what affordable housing means for a neighborhood, things like that. And you've already begun with some of the work you've done to sort of have some of those tougher, take some of those tougher stances and have some of those tougher conversations and say, everybody's got to, every part of the borough has to do its part. That's going well for you so far. I mean, you're comfortable with that in moving ahead with some of the, you know, again, if some version of the governor's plan goes through that mandates growth targets for every community district, I mean, that's going to lead to some serious, discussions, intense, conversations about development in some Bronx communities.
Yep. And, you know, the reality is I don't think these communities have always been challenged. And sometimes they have been very resistant, very NIMBYism and in opposition to projects. And unfortunately, the elected officials that represent those particular districts have stood with the communities. And I understand, but this is a new administration. This is a new wave of leadership, and we have to be responsible. We have to be collaborative. And ultimately, we can and we will support responsible development that brings jobs, that brings stability. Because at the end of the day, we have got to be a city of yes that welcomes residents from all communities. And we can't have this idea that affordable housing brings criminals and more crime. And some of the things I've heard in my tenure that blow my mind. Someone told me that people that live in affordable housing don't work hard. I said, would you believe that some of them actually have two jobs because they can't afford the rent because they're rent burdened. But those are the people we have to help the most so that they can have a pathway to home ownership, just like you were able to get, you know? And so sometimes they're not the best of conversations, but I am going to push. I'm not going to be a borough president that is, you know, talking about the same neighborhoods over and over again when it's not fair, when we know that every neighborhood really needs to have these same discussions. And I'm going to do more to prepare my community boards when ULURPs come so they are prepared for some of these projects that are a little bit more controversial that they may not be prepared for.
In our last couple minutes here, I was going to start with this. You said something that took me in a different direction. So I wanted to make sure that we get back to it, though, because public health was a real focus of your State of the Borough speech. And it's a big focus of your agenda and your administration. And I was going to start with it, like I said, and something took me in a different direction. So I want to make sure we get to it. Tell people a couple of the top promises and plans that you are putting into motion related to public health, including maternal health in the Bronx.
Right. So maternal health, super important to me. Black women are 9.2 times more likely than white women to die during childbirth because they don't get the same level of care. I am a huge advocate of birth workers, doulas, and midwives because I believe that everyone should have the health equity and justice they rightfully deserve. I am going to be building out a brand new Bronx birthing center, which does not exist and exists in other parts of our city. We're working with Mayor Adams and Governor Hochul, and we are also going to release a birthing center report that's going to highlight some of these disparities. And we are very laser focused on diabetes. We're building out a task force, because many families live with diabetes today, and many of them that are living with them are older adults. And we've been focusing on lupus and fibroids because they predominantly affect women of color. And we're really working with our hospital partners, our FQHCs, school-based health centers, all of our hospitals from Montefiore to St. Barnabas, Bronx Care, and our three public hospitals, Lincoln, Jacoby, and North Central. You remember we saved the neonatal unit at North Central, which closed for a little while and was now reopened. So we want to make sure that all birthing individuals have access to care in the Bronx. To me, it's a matter of equity and justice and fairness in the system. And when you think about us being number 62 out of all 62 counties, that number is alarming. We have been making progress in other factors, other indicators by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, but we're still number 62. So to me, this is happening because of systemic racism. And I believe that our health and human services team, we're building out, we have an HIV/AIDS task force, we have a domestic violence task force, we're building out a diabetes task force. So we're doing a lot of work. But as you know, sometimes, whether it's Mpox, it's Legionnaires, it's Ebola, there's always something that erupts, that hits the city of New York like a storm. But then when it hits the Bronx, it's like a torrential. And so we have to react to that, in which we will. But I think our short and long term goals are very clear in our strategic plan.
And just quickly, the birthing center you mentioned, is that in the very early stages of development, or do you know where that's going to be?
It's in the very early stages. I'm actually looking at some underutilized city-owned property. You know, the city has a lot of property across the city that's not utilized. So we've been working closely with DCAS, with Dawn Pienaar, the commissioner, because I do want to make sure that we can solidify a site as quickly as possible.
All right. We got to a lot, and I'll leave you there. Thank you very much for all the time. Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson, thanks for joining me to talk about some of your State of the Borough agenda and other issues facing the Bronx. And we'll catch up more down the line.
Absolutely. Yes. Hope there's a part two so we can talk about youth and getting ready for the summertime, youth employment. The summer youth employment applications are already available, and we want to make sure we focus on young people applying. But we also have, again, my brother's keeper, my sister's keeper, lots of things on youth.
Absolutely. And so we're speaking here on Friday, March 3rd, so people can hear that and have some time to apply. And also worth noting, you mentioned community boards before. I saw you extended the deadline for community board applications. So people have until March 15th to apply to the borough president's office to be on a community board in the Bronx. So people should take a look at that as well. All right. Bronx Borough President Vanessa Gibson, thanks very much.
Thank you. Happy Women's History Month too, to all my women out there.
listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
The real issue is repression against anyone who is exercising what we say are our constitutional rights of freedom of speech.
Ella Baker, co-founder of the Christian Leadership Conference to Fight Racism and the inspiring force behind SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, after the Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter sit-ins. Along with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, SNCC organized the 1961 Freedom Rides and in 64 Freedom Summer to register black voters in Mississippi. Baker says marches are necessary to dramatize injustice, but asks why march to Washington.
Why not march to Long Island? Why not march to Westchester? Why not march to the slums of New Jersey? Why not march to Harlem, to Bedford-Stuyvesant? Not in terms of a physical march, but in terms of recognizing that what is happening in these places in terms of poverty is a responsibility that has to be dealt with by those who are not impoverished. In other words, those of us who have money have got to speak to those who are in power.
Ella Baker says voting is the key. The Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Today advocates for books, not bars, jobs, not jails, health care, not handcuffs. You can hear more Ella Baker and other trailblazers from WBAI's Women's History Collection by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member of WBAI. $15 a month makes you a sustaining member, a WBAI buddy. You'll receive our extensive Women's History Collection plus WBAI's tote bag, and we'll throw in a special gift. Please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950 to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite WBAI program or in the name of all WBAI shows. 212-209-2950. We're looking for more people to become WBAI buddies. 212-209-2950. Or please go to this website, women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy on this Women's History Day.
WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. And you are invited to attend. The CAB, or CAB, is an advisory board which reviews programming and other station policies. It represents the diverse views and interests of the communities WBAI serves. If you want to attend the meeting, you can join by teleconference at 619-309-1058. And the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is invited to call in and join the meeting. And we're happy that more people are now attending CAB meetings. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058 and the PIN number 641711. We hope that you'll be able to attend. That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.
Next Town Hall, Effective Directing of Resources for Good Influence, will be Sunday, March 26th at 4 p.m. The candidate is running for office. Do you donate to their campaign? Maybe. If it qualifies them to get into debates where they are going to force discussion of certain issues. In a flood of emails, you are asked to donate, again, to a political party. Do you do it? And have your money be the tail on a dog funded by lots of mega corporations? Where do you put your money to influence the world for the better? What about sending some of your money and resources to WBAI and Pacifica for the influence it can have on the world? Next question. When resources come into WBAI and Pacifica, how can they best be directed within the Pacifica environment? To improve programming, attracting audiences, or to promote good shows already here? This is what's up for discussion. Give us your thoughts. Zoom in by computer or by Zoom. Go to WBAI's Town Hall webpage for the Zoom link information and phone number sign-in information.
The previous program was Axe Politics with Ben Max, heard Friday.